So good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. It is Monday, June 10th, and this is an informational hearing only, or informational meeting, I should say. The committee is officially closed for committee business, but we were allowed by the Senate President to hold an informational meeting. We have today two items on our agenda, an update on the Columbia River Treaty Review, and we also have a report from Beyond Toxics on the Triangle Lake issue. We heard a bill, Senate Bill 800, so we heard a little bit about that, and so that's a follow-up to my senators. Just getting started. So the update on the Columbia River Treaty Review, a little bit of background on that. We had a public hearing on a bill that would have required the governor and the Water Resources Department, but mainly the governor, to report to the Natural Resources Committees in the House and Senate. So what we did today, we actually adopted a budget note that is in the Water Resources Department's budget that was passed out of the Natural Resources Ways and Means Subcommittee that put in their budget a advisory to them, or requirement, you could say. It's not force of law, but it said that they will come and report to us. And so today you could sort of say it's considered the first report back. And so we will have regular reports at all of our meetings. So I've asked or invited the governor's office, Richard Whitman, the Natural Resources Policy Director, and Phil Ward, the Director of the Water Resources Department, to provide us with an update on this important process that's going forward. And with that, I'll invite those two gentlemen up. And we have Senator Whitsup is joined us as a guest, and we're expecting, I think, Representative Bence as well. Welcome, Senator, and let us know if you have any questions. And I didn't know if there was anything on OLIS.
Madam Chair and committee members, I believe there are two exhibits on OLIS that have been submitted by the presenters, one for each item.
Right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Richard Whitman, Governor's Natural Resource Policy Advisor, here today with Phil Ward, the Director of the Water Resources Department. Pleasure to be here today with the committee and with Senator Whitsitt to talk about this important issue, the Columbia River Treaty. Three of you were at a briefing we did back in February, on February 27th, earlier this year, on the Columbia River Treaty process.
Sorry, we have a little pause here? Yes. We have Representative Bence. We have a seat for you up here if you'd like to join us, and Representative Roblin. So you can see this is the hot ticket item for today.
You've been devoted again.
Senator Roblin.
I don't mind.
Senator, join.
Come over, sit with me. So I'm not at the end of that, guys.
Exactly.
There we go. Sorry, Senator. I was thinking Representative Bence, and here we go. Representative, welcome.
Thank you for the invitation.
I think Senator Bates is joining us finally. Okay, gentlemen.
Wow.
Yeah. All of a sudden, it got a little
warm.
Yeah. Now it gets real. Anyway, I'm just going to quickly redo my introduction for the benefit of the folks who just walked in a little bit late. As you can see, this is an informational meeting only. Just wanted a reminder for folks listening over the internet that this our committee is officially closed. But we had a hearing on a bill to require the governor's office to report to House and Senate Environment Committees on the Columbia River Treaty Review. Today, in the Water Resources Department's budget, we adopted a budget note that directed the Water Resources Department to do that. And you could say today is officially the first day that they're reporting here. And just for folks listening, we will ask for updates at our interim committee meetings in September and I think November. Whenever our meetings are, December, I can't remember when they've been scheduled for, but certainly we'll have that on the agenda. So I invited the governor's office and the Water Resources Department here today to provide us with an update, and appreciate you doing that on short notice, gentlemen. And with that, we will ask you to proceed. And Beth mentioned that there's some exhibits on OLIS that should be there under today's meeting. So with that, I'll hand it back to you, Richard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you have written testimony from Phil Ward in the Oregon Water Resources Department that are among the materials on OLIS. I was just about to say that we will also send to Beth Riley, the administrator, a copy of the PowerPoint presentation that was done by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Bonneville Power Administration, Steve Oliver and Dave Ponganis, who helped us with the briefing we did on February 27th earlier this year on the Columbia River Treaty. So that also provides a good overview and provides some graphics. So I'm sorry I wasn't able to get that to the committee administrator earlier, but we'll get it to you right after this. So let me just run through what the Columbia River Treaty is at a very high level and where we are in the process of looking at whether to extend, modify, or terminate, at least in part, the provisions of the Columbia River Treaty. This is a very important treaty between the United States and Canada dealing with management of water resources and power in the Pacific Northwest. The treaty was ratified back in the 60s by the United States and Canada. And at a very high level, the treaty called for the creation of three new dams in Canada and allowed for the creation of an additional dam in the United States in Montana, with a total new storage of over 15 million acre feet of water in the Columbia Basin. That is a lot of water. And that water provides significant benefits in a number of different respects for both Canada and the United States. First of all, in terms of hydroelectric generation, the water storage is managed by Canada to maximize power benefits by releasing it at times when it can be utilized in hydroelectric facilities downstream on the Columbia when times of need are the greatest. And that's worth on the order of $250 to $350 million a year in terms of power benefits. Under the terms of the treaty, half of that additional revenue that's generated through these storage facilities is sent back to Canada. It's the so-called Canadian entitlement. And that's one of the main benefits of this treaty for Canada. Another major benefit of the treaty for the United States is in the area of flood control. Under the treaty, 8.5 million acre feet is contracted long-term for a 60-year period by the United States for flood control purposes in the Columbia Basin. These dams provide by far the vast majority of flood control storage on the Columbia system. So for our downstream communities in Oregon and Washington, this is the main source of operational storage for flood control purposes. The treaty doesn't have a termination date. It instead provides that it provides for a 10-year notice of termination, which in the earliest possible notice of termination that could be given is in 2014 for termination in 2024. And when I say termination, the treaty doesn't terminate in its entirety. The flood control provisions of the treaty continue on, although in somewhat different form, even if one side or the other calls for termination. What would continue if one side or the other calls for termination is essentially what's called upon storage. So the United States, if termination were to occur, could still call upon these three dams in Canada for flood control storage, but, and this is a really important but, only after the United States has shown that it has used all existing flood control storage within its portion of the Columbia Basin for flood control. So Brownlee Reservoir and other reservoirs in the United States would have to be operated for flood control before the U.S. could call on Canada for storage for flood control purposes. So it would result in major changes in the operation of the facilities on the United States side of the border. Probably less operation for hydro, certainly would change some of the operations that currently occur under the biological opinions for the power system would really result in some major changes. So leading up to this period, in starting in 2014, when Canada or the U.S. could call for termination, the what's called the U.S. entity has set up a process for development of recommendations to the U.S. Department of State on whether to extend, modify, or terminate the treaty provisions. The U.S. entity, the lead on this is Bonneville Power and the Corps of Engineers, and they have put together what is called the Sovereign Review Team, the SRT, made up of Northwest tribes, the states involved, and the federal agencies involved in this, to develop a recommendation along with the U.S. entity to the State Department. And that recommendation, speaking to the process part of this, is due at the end of this year. So for the last several years, the U.S. entity has been holding a series of public meetings throughout the Columbia Basin. They've been doing a series of iterations of modeling of different scenarios for what the treaty might look like after 2024. The last series of public meetings, informational sessions were done in April and May this spring. And the SRT, Sovereign Review Team, is now in the process of developing a draft SRT recommendation. That draft SRT recommendation is expected to be completed in later this month in June, and will then be released for public review and comment at the end of June and on into July. There also are additional public meetings that the U.S. entity expects to hold in the basin in July to get basically final public comment on this recommendation to the State Department. I want to emphasize that even though this part of the process is very important in terms of coming to a regional recommendation, it is a recommendation to the U.S. Department of State. It is the State Department ultimately that will decide what to negotiate with Canada. And that process will begin in 2014 and will likely continue through or close to through 2024. So we are really nearing the end of what I would call round one in this process, and probably just entering into round two, which will be direct discussions between the United States and Canada over what to do with this treaty leading up to 2024. So that's a little background and process. I want to speak briefly about Oregon's interest in this, and then ask Director Ward if he has other things he wants. Oregon has really taken a holistic approach in terms of our input to the Sovereign Review Team. I should mention that our Power Planning Council members, Bill Bradbury and Henry Lorenzen, have been the leads for Oregon on the Sovereign Review Team. And when I say holistic approach, I mean we're really trying to make sure that Oregon is advocating for all of the interest in this treaty. So that includes hydropower, power generation. It also includes management of flood risk. It also includes ecosystem function and water quality. It also includes looking at opportunities for new sources of winter storage for water supply and economic development in parts of the state of Oregon and the state of Washington. It also means looking at interests in terms of navigation. Our ports, both on the Oregon side and Washington side, have been engaged more recently in looking at potential impacts on water levels in the Columbia River, particularly in light of the significant investment in Columbia River deepening done over the last 10 years. So we're trying to make sure that all those interests are acknowledged and well represented in the recommendation to the U.S. Department of State. And I think we're optimistic that the SRT is making good progress on a draft recommendation. And as I said, we expect to see that draft out in the next couple of weeks. So with that sort of overview, Director Ward, any things that you want to add?
So, Madam Chair, members, just a couple really quick things. I just would note that...
Phil, can you put your name on the record, please?
I'm sorry. Phil Ward with the Department of Water Resources. Just a couple quick things to note. Our staff, along with staff from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, have served on what's called the technical review team. So these two folks, an individual from my staff and an individual from ODF&W, has been supporting the sovereign review team that Richard mentioned in creating this portfolio. And one of the particular things that my staff person has been involved in, and in cooperation with the ODF&W folks, was the development of this concept around water supply and getting that included as a part of the portfolio that the Army Corps of Engineers has included in their formal scoping for the project. So that wasn't really a part of the equation early on, but we've worked with Fish and Wildlife Department where we're talking about water supply both for out-of-stream uses and then for uses relative to fish needs in the basin as well. So that now has been formally adopted as part of the portfolio for the scoping process, and we're encouraged that they're paying attention to the states in that regard. The state of Washington's also been a good partner in that effort. So that, I think, Madam Chair, is all I need to add at this time, and with Mr. Whitman, I think we'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. I have a few questions, but we'll see if there's any from up at the dais first. Any questions, Senator Hansel?
I just want to try to get clear in my mind. Obviously, the State Department is negotiating country to country. Underneath the State Department, we have these committees, advisory kind of things, the advisory board. Is the State Department personnel involved in any of the negotiations or the discussions at the lower echelons, if you will, of the governmental hierarchy engaged in at this point?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, not at this point, at least not directly. I do understand that there are some discussions that go on regularly between the U.S. entity, which is the Corps, and Bonneville Power Administration and the State Department, but the State Department has not been directly involved in the sovereign review team work so far.
Did you follow up?
Follow up. Are there other states that are involved other than the Columbia Basin states as far as and the U.S. side that are involved?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, not to my knowledge, certainly not at this point. You know, at some point, if there is an amendment to this treaty that has to come back to Congress for ratification, we could see other states get involved at that point. That may be what you're alluding to.
One last question, if I might. On the Canadian provenance side, do they have similar structures to what we have on the U.S. side?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, yes. And the Canadian entity is made up of BC Hydro and... I think there is one other entity involved in the lead for BC.
The provinces have an involvement.
Yeah, okay.
And First Nations.
Yes.
Senator Hess?
Thank you. This is just a comment, not really a question, just a kind of an overview and just to, I guess, drive home how important this is. 1996 was this horrible flood. That hit us, and I was a news guy then, and it was supposed to flood downtown Portland. And it probably would have 100 years ago. It was a 100-year flood. But it didn't, and the reason it did was because of the arrangements and the things that they were doing in Canada in those reservoirs that kept that water from going into those streets, and it just went right up to the edge, and they stopped it. It was just kind of a miracle if you wind that river all the way back up there a couple of thousand miles to see those efforts. And to me, that's what a lot of this is about.
Absolutely.
If I could, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Haas, flood risk has been high on our priority list to talk with other members of the SRT and with the Corps and Bonneville Power about. And there are a couple of different operational scenarios being looked at in terms of flood flows. We're watching that very carefully. I know the Corps also has taken a very strong position that because of the congressional authorization for the Columbia River system, they are essentially required to stick with existing flood risk levels. But there has been some discussion about increasing the potential level of flow for operations of the system. And I think to the extent that that discussion continues, there's going to be a need for a more public vetting of that issue. And certainly before anything goes close to Congress, there'd have to be broad discussion of the implications of that.
Any questions over here? Senator Olson and Senator Whitsett.
Mr. Whitman, and it was a good question that Senator Haas asked about flood control. Is there a coordination between the Upper Willamette River dams and the Columbia River dams for flood control?
Madam Chair, Senator, correlation's an interesting question. Certainly that system, there's the attempt to manage the system as a whole in the flood situation, and in the sense that the Corps manages the Willamette system to minimize flood damage in the key population centers, as Senator Haas articulated, yes, I think there is definitely a coordination and a correlation in terms of how that whole system is managed.
Follow up. Mr. Whitman, in your holistic approach, the one that you didn't mention was climate change. Have you defined post-2024 what the climate will look like and what our water issues are?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, I haven't defined anything in this process, but I can tell you that the Corps, the Bureau of Reclamation, and other federal agencies involved in this SRT process are all looking at long-term models of the hydrology in the basin and predicted changes in the hydrology of the basin, how it will affect power generation, how it will affect flood risk, and all the other values that we're trying to gain out of the operation of this system. So I know we are looking at long-term modeling for what climate change is likely to do in terms of operation of the Columbia system.
One follow-up. Is there any results? Have they determined anything?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, I know there are some preliminary results of some initial modeling of hydrology. I'll give you the picture. The hydrograph for the Columbia is expected to shift so that peak flows will be earlier in the year as a result of less precipitation falling as snow and more precipitation falling as rain. That's probably the major effect.
Thank you.
Senator Whitsett.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Whitman, following along that same line of questioning, it seems to me the key to this whole treaty, the key to this whole renegotiation is what the Canadian government might want in return for continuing the flood control aspect. If they were to follow the treaty after 2014 and allow and require the United States to do their own flood control up to the on-call part, that would change the hydroelectric generation, irrigation, fish management, shipping, navigation, recreational fisheries. The tribal treaty would change everything. Mm-hmm. In fact, it would very likely make the shipping on the river practically impossible. So do we have any clue as to what the Canadians might be thinking is in any changes they might want for the storage capacity for flood control in exchange for the Canadian entitlement?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Whitsett, I don't think there's been any, certainly no formal position from Canada at this time. You need to remember, though, that the U.S. is not entirely without leverage in this situation because of the Canadian entitlement aspect of the treaty. There's a significant financial interest on the part of Canada in maintaining some form of sharing of the benefits of hydroelectric generation. So I think the negotiation will probably center around those two central parts of the treaty that were, you know, the part of the original treaty in the 1960s, hydroelectric generation and flood storage.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up, if I might.
Follow-up.
And Mr. Whitman, if the Canadians decided to retrofit their dams to generate their own electricity, then what?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Whitsitt, I don't have enough information to be able to answer that at this point. I assume there would be some significant cost in doing that. Mm-hmm. And even if that's a way of generating additional revenue for BC Hydro, there still is the downstream effects of that and the downstream increase in hydroelectric generation that is an additional benefit that's subject to negotiation between the two countries.
And that would be buffered by the need to control, the need for maintaining more reservoir capacity for storage, however.
Senator Dingfelder, or Chair Dingfelder, Senator Whitsitt, if BC Hydro were to retrofit those dams to start generating electricity, I think a lot of the management of water for that purpose would likely be similar to current management of water in terms of when the need for power generation and when the rates and revenue that can be generated from that are maximized. So even if Canada were to do that, I think the releases of water that you would see downstream would, and I, you know, not being an expert here, but just at a high level, I think would likely be similar to what we see now.
So Representative Bentz had his hand up, and then Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you again for the invitation to join you this afternoon, and thank you for all your hard work on this, hugely important. I noticed when I went to the four or five of the meetings, scoping meetings I've attended, the complexity of the situation is really amazing. Mm-hmm. And as the iterations have progressed, the reasons that we should be concerned are becoming more clear. And so it would be easier now to identify what our greatest concern should be, what our greatest fear should be, what our greatest opportunity might be as a result of this exercise, this once every half century exercise. I had the good fortune of meeting with Consul General from British Columbia, who came down to talk about the issues, and he suggested that that everyone should consider amending the treaty rather than terminating it. Which I thought was interesting for a number of reasons, but I would be interested in two thoughts from you. The first, three really. Do you have the staff necessary to attack the monster that this treaty renegotiation constitutes? Second, can you share with us today what you see as our greatest opportunity and greatest challenge? And third, do you recommend that we do more than we've been doing when it comes to taking advantage of this 50-year opportunity?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Bentz, good questions.
I hope you wrote those down.
I did. or I tried to at any rate. And let me take them in a slightly different order than they were asked. So let me talk about opportunities and challenges first. In terms of challenges, I think the and this is personal opinion, let me be clear about that. I think the main challenges I see at this point are with regard to flood control risk and with regard to sharing of the hydroelectric generation, the original sort of two central purposes of the treaty. I think there is a significant opportunity for water supply, multi-purpose water supply development and use also. But frankly, in the scheme of things, the flood risk piece is pretty high up there for me, with concern about the potential economic implications for the lower part of the basin. In terms of opportunities, you know, on the revenue side for the Canadian entitlement, obviously we're sending a lot of money to Canada, and I think there's a general sense on this side of the border that that portion of the treaty should be renegotiated, and should be a more equitable sharing, whatever that means, of the hydroelectric benefits of the treaty. So that's an opportunity economically for Washington and Oregon, all the customers of Bonneville Power, in terms of potentially lower power rates. So I think those are the main opportunities and challenges that I would point out. On staffing levels, we're getting, I think, good representation on the technical team from the Water Resources Department and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Could we use more staff? You know, you talk to a bureaucrat, he's never going to tell you that we couldn't use more staff. I am on the flood risk piece. We've pushed for a little bit more attention on that. Frankly, the experts on the flood risk issue are the core. And I think the core have largely the same interests that we do on that particular issue. So in terms of doing more, we have we are at a point pretty close to the end. There will be, as I said, a draft recommendation that comes out in a couple of weeks. There will be a relatively short couple of month period for us to influence that draft before it goes to the State Department. And then once things get to the State Department, you know, then we're into a new ball game in terms of the direct discussions with Canada. I think all of the sovereigns and agencies are, I'm sure, thinking about how do we, assuming we get into a negotiation with Canada, which I expect we will, how do we stay engaged in this process over a 10-year period? And at this point, I don't have an answer to that, but my expectation is we are going to need to stay very closely engaged in this, even more so over the next 2 or 3 years, almost more than we are now, as things go into what I would call real negotiations.
So, Richard, that was the question that I was going to ask, and just as a follow-up to Representative Bent's question, do we have a sense of how that's going to be defined? In other words, my understanding is, like you said, there's a recommendation, then it's the State Department goes into negotiations with Canada. Will there be opportunities, sort of feedback opportunities, between the SRT and the State Department during that 10, because that's a 10-year stretch, is my understanding, that negotiation time frame. Do you have any indications from the Corps?
I'll try, and then Director Ward may be able to add to this. And I have to be a little careful what I say here, because the discussions of the SRT are confidential within the SRT. But in a general way, there has been discussion about a need for a public process even after the recommendation is made to state. And I think there is going to be advocacy among not only the SRT members but the U.S. entity, I expect, for continuing public engagement and engagement of the sovereigns as this moves forward. I can't tell you exactly what that's going to look like at this point.
Phil, did you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, the only thing I'd add is that, you know, I really think that is one of the kind of the key challenges, is maintaining that engagement as we move into this next phase and doing it in a meaningful way. And I'm not sure that's, as Richard's indicated, that's not fully clear today how that process will work. But it is something I think we're alert to and are definitely committed to finding that path for engagement down the road.
Representative Vince, did you have a follow-up?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I didn't say this quite as clearly as I should have, but in one of the first meetings, over in Boise. It appeared to me that no one quite knew what we should be worried about. What, as a result of all this, what bad, horrible thing could happen to Oregon? And as these iterations progress, we hope to have a clearer picture of that so that you could advise us of the damage and the cost of that damage to this state. Will we have less power? Will we have less water? Here's the true economic damage that we could suffer as a result of a bad outcome. So we in turn could take that to our senators and congressional delegation and say, we need help and here's the measure of it. When do you think we'll be in a position to be able to, as I put it in Boise, know how brightly our hair should be on fire? What is it that we should be worried about? When will we know?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Bentz, I think you'll start to know part of that when you see the draft recommendation, which will come out in the next couple of weeks. But I think that also will be pretty high level. And I think ongoing modeling that's being done by the Corps and Bonneville Power on flood control operations and hydroelectric production under different scenarios are what I would be looking at in terms of when my hair might go on fire. I think the big risks for Oregon are, the potential, if we lose that Canadian storage for flood control, as Senator Whitsitt noted, there could be significant implications for operations of the Columbia River system, including the Snake River system, that could have could damage navigation, recreation, fisheries, just the whole host of interest that we have. On the hydro side, if Canada isn't managing those three dams to maximize power generation, notwithstanding the fact that we're not sending half of the power back to them, there could, under certain scenarios, be a loss of power generation capacity by Bonneville Power, which is, you know, some of the firm power base of our entire generation system. I think the number is 43% of our power comes from hydro in Oregon. So those are, I think, the two big risks that we should be watching, and it's the modeling iteration results that I think really tell us what the potential implications are.
Is that, hold on, Senator Bates had a question, and then we can go back to
it's been partially answered, actually, by by your answer to General Milov. I had a couple of questions just real quick. First, it's very intriguing. Many of you know I lived up in Canada for a long time, and so I've seen it from both sides. And BC Hydro was loved and hated up there just as much as everybody loves and hates Bonneville down here. So it's very common conversation both ways. My memory of those dams is that they are in a location in Canada with low population, and retrofitting them and transmitting the power would be pretty expensive. I think the Canadians would rather just have the money. And I'm guessing that's going to be one of the things that might set our hair on fire if they're asking for a lot of money for what they're doing already. I'm guessing that's going to be part of what's going on. And you mentioned that some of the power is being shared back through. Is it from the Bonneville back through Seattle and back up?
Yes.
Is that how they're doing it? Okay, I expect so. I guess what it comes down to is we have to wait and see. I mean, we have a good cooperative arrangement with Canadians right now, but that could change rather quickly. They're in a position, it seems to me, to control what happens on their side of the border and don't have a lot of incentive to work with us other than receiving power and financial reward for doing what they're doing. On the other hand, I don't think they're ready to retrofit those dams and run transmission lines across those mountains back in the lower mainland where all the population is.
Right.
So my guess, that's kind of what the dynamic is that's going to go on here.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, it's very possible, if not likely, that neither side will trigger the 10-year termination notice and that we'll just get into a period of negotiation here with the threat of termination being the driver for people to stay at the table.
I think so.
And just to let the representative, good representative, Senator, just joined us. I think they're here for the second part of the the meeting. We're just wrapping up this first part, but we're still on the Columbia River Treaty discussion. Senator Whitsitt, did you have another question?
I do. Mr. Whitman, Oregon has traditionally not been on the same page with Idaho and Washington on the use of Columbia River water for irrigation. They're, in short, they're using the water and we're not. So Oregon is taking a holistic approach. Are the other states, Washington, Idaho, Montana, on that same page, or are they taking a different tack?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Whitsitt, I can tell you that Oregon's position is very similar to Washington's, and that the two states have been talking and working cooperatively on their approaches. And I've read some of the materials from Washington and the Sovereign Review Team, and it's very close to what we're doing. So I think we're working very closely with Washington. I can't speak really to Idaho, at least as of, I just don't know for Idaho. So I'd be happy to look into that and get back to you.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Senator Hansel?
Richard, are you going to be planning to be still working on this in 24-24?
You may want to plead, you
sure
know, the fifth on that one.
So I won't have any hair left by then. But, I think this will be going on for quite a while for all of us.
Well, if there are no other questions, Senator Roblin, did you have a question?
Nope, I think they pretty much did it. I'm just concerned that we will have to lower our levels of our lakes to make sure that we're okay for the flood control and therefore not have water if we have a bad year. And,
yep.
And that appears to be the big issue that's going on with regard to the flood control. And my history of the way the newest models are coming out is that, yes, the general trend is that it will come sooner because there won't be as much storage and a little cotton and rain. But the other part of that same story is that there will be bigger and more violent storms, which will be unpredictable and don't know when the rain's going to come. So that means that you all of a sudden have to prepare for the unexpected, which means have less water to hold the rain back if you get a freak storm. And that makes me very concerned if we can't keep the storage in Canada.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Roblin, and for the Portland-Vancouver area, it's really the interaction of the Willamette system and the Columbia system. So you have to, in looking at the modeling and the operation, you have to be looking at both of those together. So it gets very complicated.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, if anybody had any doubts about the significance of that storage, I had the opportunity to be up in Libby, Montana last summer, and cycled around, I can't say the whole thing because it probably would have taken me several days to cycle around the Kookanuska Reservoir, which is absolutely massive, and it gives you a sense of the amount of storage that's occurring up there. I appreciate both of you coming on short notice. We will certainly have an update in September, which I think is going to be a crucial time, have that update, and look forward to hearing more. And I would encourage many of you, the staff will send out a link to the Columbia River Treaty 2014-2024 review website, and there's a lot of technical presentations on there if you want to dive deeper. But I think this is a very important issue, and we'll look forward to hearing more, and by then we will all have seen what the recommendations are as well. And so appreciate you coming in and providing that. So be forewarned in September, and representatives and senators, you're welcome to join us again back then. So thank you very
much.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Representative and Senator Whitsitt, Representative Bentz. And Senator Roblin, you're welcome to stay if that's for the next part as well.
Yep.
So the second part of our informational meeting today is a report on an update on the Triangle Lake situation. So we have Representative Holvey and Senator Przanski who have joined us along with Representative Roblin. And I don't know
Senator Roblin still,
but Senator Roblin, I keep doing that. Would either of Senator Roblin, I know this is in your district, so I wanted to see if you wanted to say a few comments, and Representative Holvey, I know you've been working on this for a long time, so before we ask the presenters to come up, if either of you gentlemen just wanted to provide any background, or we had a hearing on Senate Bill 800, and we heard a little bit on the background, and So this was a follow-up to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll take the prerogative.
I apologize again about calling. Just, you can hit me next time I call you representative.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, and I know that this subject matter stirs a lot of emotion, a lot of opinions, and, you know, it has come to me and part of my district and part of Arnie's district, part of Floyd's district, where we've been contacted by people who have identified pesticides in their urine, and, you know, that causes anybody to have a little bit of alarm and, you know, want to get to the bottom of what's going on. And so Triangle Lake, as you know, has been an area where there's been a lot of complaints around pesticides in the communities dating back several years. And so they, you know, just after the state, I think, became aware of these claims that were, you know, done by scientists and had documentation on the process they went through that identified these toxins. As you know, the park team did an investigation, and what was a little bit troubling is it took them an awfully long time to get the data to be able to, and still questionable whether they really got the data that would enable them to make any kind of conclusion about what happened, or, you know, what the source was, or, you know, what exactly is causing toxins to be in certain communities. And so that's what generated Senate Bill 800, was trying to get the data, the disclosure of that information by the agencies involved more centralized into a program, so that data is available to OHA to be able to make the kind of findings that would actually protect the public's health. So that was what, you know, the genesis of Senate Bill 800 was, and it was a lot because of some of the reports that were come out and the studies that were being done, and how that wasn't exactly what we were hearing from state government. So Beyond Toxics did a tremendous amount of work with scientists as well, and so that's where we are today. And I think they had a report that they wanted to bring forward earlier, but we weren't able to get that done. And, you know, subsequently, the park team released their report, as you know.
Senator Rowland, did you want to add?
And for me, I came to this a little later because this district changed the last session. We did the redistricting. I have gone and talked with a number of people in the Triangle Lake area, in particular a number of people who have lived there for a long, long time and who initially really were engaged in the process and wanted the OHA and the park group to come in and do the research. And they've gotten the results back. They tend to believe that the results have been pretty clear, that it's not a big hazard, it has not been a health hazard to them, and want to see if they can get over with this and get on with rebuilding a community where people talk to each other. And I think that's the biggest issue. I think the biggest issue that was surprising to me in the OHA report and the park report was the fact that the biggest health concern may be the inability for all these people to work together and live together in a community, because it causes more tension in the area rather than the pesticides or these other kinds of issues. And I would love to see a community start working together and understanding that they can do things in different ways and still result in a healthy community and make things work. And so I'm here to hear what the other stuff. I was surprised by the some of the information that came out in the park study, the fact that there was two sets of data. One was collected locally, not through the OHA, and in that one, when they got all the reports and the results back, they found a discrepancy that some of the people had atrazine in their system, even though the records indicated that it hadn't been used yet and sprayed. So there's a concern about where that could have happened and where it came from. Of the 19 different tests, I think 13 of them happened, the people gave the urine samples prior to the reports showing that there had actually been any spraying done that year. So it has some interesting kinds of dilemmas, and I would love to see how we can kind of build this community back, because it is a beautiful place in the state, and I've known people from that school for a long, long time. Some of my good friends from past educational stuff are people who live in that area. So I would love to make sure that people can get along in that community and make the place work. And I think there are a lot of different people who have different practices. I think they should all be done appropriately and within the law. And I think if we do that, we can make that valley work well together. So I'm here to hear what this portion has to do, because I haven't really talked to as many of these people.
Senator Presente, did you want to add?
Yes, thank you. Just a couple of things. First, the Beyond Toxics approached Paul and myself regarding some of the research they were doing in data. I actually got to see a presentation earlier in the spring, and after that, it was one of those things I thought was important for this committee to actually have an opportunity to see, and more importantly, for the governor's and governor's staff and the work group that the, or task force as it may be called, that the governor's office is going to be putting together regarding the data itself and how it's actually received and where it's going to be collected. As Representative Hovey said, there seems to be a disconnect as to being able to get the data on a systematic basis. Currently, the applicator must retain the records themselves. There's no requirement for them to be actually shared or given to an agency unless there is a request for it. That is one of the issues I believe that came out pretty apparent, that it was a very slow in getting that data delivered to them so they could actually do the work that they need to do. And as I've told people on multiple sides of this issue, what we need to do is get down to the bare facts of what is actually happening or not happening. And if it is a health issue, then we need to address it, and we need to address it accordingly. And if not, then we need to be able to substantiate why and that is or isn't. One of the things that we do know is that the way the application process works now, notice is given as to what might be considered to be used. No one knows until and even after it's actually been applied what actually was used. There's been some question as to whether or not there may be a mixing of some of the different substances and making what some people may call a cocktail type of solution that will work for applications for whatever their goals are. But what I've also been told is in many of those cases, if you start mixing various chemicals and substances, not really sure what you may end up with and what the impact may be. So I think it's just really important for us to kind of find out where we're at. If there is an issue, we need to ensure that the agencies that are there to protect everyone's health, be it residents, be it workers, or anyone else that may come in contact with these areas, are taken care of. And, you know, that's one of those things I hope that we have an opportunity to get to and have some disclosure, because if there is a problem, let's deal with it. If it's not, then as Senator Roblin said, then maybe, you know, it's time to move on. But it does seem fair and that if we have health concerns that are raised, that we look into that to see what, if any, merit. And you have to realize that in this particular case, this did activate a significant resource issue driven to try to get information, but even through the conversations with the governor's office as it pertained to being able to get those documents, they had grave difficulty, and that's one of the reasons the work group has been placed together. And this is one of the reasons I have encouraged that the presenters come forward now instead of waiting, so it may in fact help the governor's process as they're doing their work and during this next interim.
Thank you for your comments, gentlemen, and we'll ask the presenters to come up.
Just a quick point of clarification.
Yeah. Sure.
I'm not sure where Triangle Lake is. Whose districts is it in?
Right there, next to you. Yeah, and they're going to show you a map, I think.
Triangle Lake is actually in my district now, but the whole surrounding area borders, right? This is right where it borders between our districts.
Yeah, the break line.
So in what county, Arnie?
They share my border.
No, this is in Lane County.
You're the representative for Triangle Lake.
No. It would be Caddy. Caddy right now.
With
he
redistricting.
Used to be. Right. He used to be with redistricting. But there is part of the Triangle Lake area, if you want to take the whole area.
This is a large area. That's just not a lake.
Right. There's a bigger part that their district adjoins mine, which just shares the same area.
We are adjacent, Bill. What we had thought when we first got in this issue, when they reached out to us, we thought under the new redistricting that Paul and my district covered that area. But in greater detail looking, it actually is Arnie's and Caddy McCowan's And so we border it, but there are people, I believe, who are impacted by this or claim to be impacted that are actually living in our district.
And to clarify, this is about the Triangle Lake area, Blatchley right. Lane, Triangle Lake, not about the lake itself.
The lake itself is in our district, clearly, but the Blatchley Lake, the whole area, there's a combination. This is our border.
Okay. So we have Lisa Arkin from Beyond Toxics and Lori Bernstein, who's a retired fisheries biologist. And ladies, you have we need to be adjourned and out of here by 5. So you have some time for presentation, and we want to have some time for questions. And I will be keeping track of the clock. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dingfelder, Chair, and members of the committee and guests here today. My name for the record is Lisa Arkin. I'm Executive Director of Beyond Toxics. And
my name is Lori Bernstein. I'm a retired fisheries biologist with the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service, and I'm represented here as a GIS specialist with Beyond Toxics.
And I first want to start by thanking Senator Przanski for his hard work to make this hearing possible, this information possible, and also Representative Holvey for his historical responsiveness to his constituents in this area, and also to Senator Roblin, who's new to this area as a representative but is here to learn and listen. Thank you all very much. We have a fair amount of data to present today, so please excuse us if we move rather quickly through these slides and read from our notes to make sure we don't leave any information out. And because of the limited time period, we are focusing today primarily on human health impacts, and this is only about a third of the data we've collected. There we go. So just to familiarize.
One of the things I just want to mention, Lisa, before we get started, that this presentation is also on OLIS, is on our legislative information system if folks want to follow along or if they want to look at it later. So it should be up. It is up because I'm looking at it right now.
Thank you. The topics we'll cover today are the 6 listed here. We have, you can read them for yourself. So we'll go through this and get all the way to policy recommendations. I'm going to hand it to Lori.
As Floyd had mentioned, or Senator Przanski, had mentioned, Oregon Health Authority came out with this report. And before doing that, in April 2011, the Oregon Board of Forestry received testimony from Dr. Dana Barr, the former director of the Pesticide Exposure Assessment Lab at the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and one of the nation's leading authorities on human exposure to pesticides. She had tested the urine from residents at Triangle Lake and found 100% of the residents tested positive and well above the national rate of exposure for atrazine and 2,4-D, 2 chemicals commonly used in commercial forestry. Her testimony led to this investigation, this health investigation. The study area is approximately 10 to 14 miles west of Eugene, mostly in Lane County. It's a total of 184,320 acres. In the investigation, Oregon Health Authority requested the commercial timber pesticide application records. And since the records became part of the public record, Beyond Toxics acquired spray records from 2009 through 2011 and did a GIS analysis. Oregon law requires applicators to keep records sprays for 3 years. It is our understanding that this is the first time in Oregon that commercial timber spray records were made available to the public. And I want you to also note that the shape in this slide of the study area, because the next several maps you'll see that shape. The purple in this slide represents the rural residential areas. The residents live right through the middle of the study area, primarily along Highway 36. There's a school in the middle of the study area, and the actual lake, the Triangle Lake itself, is also a popular destination for anglers, water sports, and picnicking. There's mixed ownership in the study area. 42% is federal forest, Forest Service and BLM. 10% is state forest. 48% is private land. The BLM is the typical checkerboard pattern. These are that you see in green here, the lighter green. These are part of the ONC lands. The state land is managed by Oregon Department of Forestry in gray, and a portion of the Siusla National Forest is in the darker green to the west of the study area. The rest is private land. This is just to show you a superimposed map of the study area on top of a 2013 aerial photo, just so you can see the extent of clear-cutting that's happening out there. The area is typical of Oregon Coastal Range, very steep terrain with many streams. Here's a photo of a clear cut of the study area, steep slopes, and notice the headwater streams in this area. For the purposes of today's presentation, we are focusing on human health and exposures in residential areas. However, we do want to point out for future discussions that there are listed fish species and designated fish habitat in the study area. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has identified these highlighted streams as salmon and steelhead habitat. Coho are listed as threatened. Steelhead are listed as species of concern, and Chinook are also found in the watershed. State and federal agencies have invested in projects that enhance fish habitat. For example, a successful fish ladder was constructed in Lake Creek Falls. Okay, so now we're going to start showing you our data, the data that we put together. We digitize all the aerial and ground spray data into GIS. GIS is Geographic Information Systems. It's a mapping software. Each of these polygons represents clear cuts units on private commercial timberlands that were sprayed. The dark red are the aerial sprayed units, and in orange are the ground sprayed areas for all of 2009 through 2011 sprays. As you can see, there's overlap in some of it, like some of the, you'll see some areas where they ground sprayed and they also aerial sprayed. In addition to that, several of these units are overlapped in themselves too. They were sprayed multiple years that you can't see here because all the data is on one map. But each spray, as Floyd mentioned, or Senator Przanski mentioned, each spray often included a variety of chemicals. Tank mixes were common. This slide separates out the aerial spray by spring and fall seasons. We clearly see a difference of the type of chemicals sprayed during each season. 2,4-D, atrazine, hexazinone are common chemicals aerial sprayed in the spring months. Glyphosate and imazapyr are aerial sprayed most often in the fall months. Spring 2011 had a higher amount of chemical spray. There was a 226% increase in pounds of pesticide sprayed from spring 2009 to spring 2011. Residents were aware of the increase in the amount of spraying going on by their homes during the spring of 2011, and health complaints became more common during these times. The urine analysis was also taken during the spring of 2011.
Question?
Yeah.
Left-hand side, what is the 2,000, 4,000, 6,000?
Yeah, those are, that got, huh, that's funny. I thought that's the pounds of pesticide product sprayed. Thought I'd fix that.
And, yeah. And, Chair Dinkfeld.
So let me follow up with that. A question then on your high peak, your analysis taken there. You've got the red line. What is the 7,800 to 11,000 pounds? What does that tell us in relationship to 2,4-D? Does that, are you saying that, what does that
so,
say?
So what that says is there was that much hexazinone sprayed, that much atrazine sprayed, and that much 2,4-D sprayed on top.
So what, but what's the error with your analysis taken showing up there at the top? What does that mean?
Oh, well, okay.
Could that arrow have been anywhere on that column? You've taken your analysis?
Yes. It's not pointing to, it's just pointing to the fact that more 2,4-D was sprayed in 2011. Sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Oops. More 2,4-D was sprayed in 2011 and more atrazine was sprayed in 2011.
Was that agriculture and?
Just commercial timber.
Just commercial timber. And do you have a relationship of how many acres was sprayed in each of those deals?
Yes.
So there was more. Were there more acres sprayed as well?
Yes.
Okay.
And we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Okay.
So basically, back up if you would please. Mm-hmm. Basically, where it says your analysis taken during the spring of 2011, that could have been put anywhere on that chart.
Yes, it's not pointing to a number. It's pointing to the fact that it's just pointing to the spike in spring 2011.
Senator Hansel.
I know in agriculture we do pounds per acre, kind of on our spray mix and stuff. So, you're getting about the same amount per acre, just that less acres are sprayed in the other years?
The pounds per acre are increasing over these 3 years, but that's not displayed in this chart.
So just to follow up on this, the acreage is constant in on those 3 years? Or
no. No, there's a 56% increase in acres sprayed from 2009 to 2011. So you know, yeah.
Your chart then shows that correlation. 56% increase is about what you have there in spring 2011.
That's actually showing a much higher. That's showing a 226% increase in spring from comparing spring 2009 to spring 2011.
Okay. 2,000% increase.
226% increase in pounds of pesticide sprayed.
And a 56% increase in acres.
Well, the 56% increase in acres is from all year, from the whole year sprayed in 2009 to the whole year sprayed in 2011. It's not looking at seasonal data.
That 104% increase.
It was 100. Some of that comes up a little later. Maybe it'll be clearer.
Okay.
When you keep going.
Chair?
Yeah.
Good question.
Yeah.
I just want to understand this better. Have you continued to do urine checks in 12 and 13, or was this a one-time sort of look at it during that time? How big was the subject? How many people were tested? And are these chemicals water-soluble or lipid-soluble? You know, if they're retained in the body or are they flushed through?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Bates, the urine analysis was only performed in 2011. It was performed in the spring by Dr. Barr, as we explained in the beginning, and then in the fall of 2011 by the Oregon Health Authority with assistance from Center for Disease Control. No other urine analysis has been done that we know of, and the efforts on the parts of the agencies to collect additional data was halted, one might say, and the study is, in a sense, at a stasis right now. And as for whether the chemicals are soluble or not, they are believed by science to flush from the body very quickly. That's what the EPA says.
Senator Hansel?
How many samples were actually taken?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, in the spring there were approximately 40. It was 39 to 41. I can't quite remember at the moment. And that was when Dr. Barr did the sampling. And then in the fall it was 60. I have it in my notes. We're not at that slide yet. Sorry. 60. Yeah. It was approximately 61, I believe.
So 40 people came to Dr. Barr's clinic and gave samples? Was that how they were collected?
As far as I know, I was not part of that sampling. Dr. Barr gave instructions as to how folks could collect urine samples with the help of a physician and provide a chain of custody as to how they were taken and how they were presented to the physician. The physician sent them to Dr. Barr's laboratory. She practices out of the University of Atlanta, Georgia.
Dr. Barr does?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. CDC.
Yeah, CDC. Did you have another question?
Yeah, I just wanted further. Of the ones tested, were they all positive?
100% on the spring, spring of 2011, Chair Dingfelder and Senator Bates were positive for both 2,4-D and atrazine. And in the fall of 2011, 92% were positive for 2,4-D and 0% for atrazine detection levels.
Senator Przanski? Yeah,
Madam Chair, I think it's important because we learned this through the process in speaking to Gail Shibley when she was still here at the state. Dr. Barr, from my understanding, is a very renowned research scientist that does a lot of work with CDC. That was one of the reasons that the department was, I'd say, more alerted because of who she is and what her credentials are. At least that's the way I took it. And so they may have more information than I have.
Okay. Why don't you keep on going? It sounds like there might be more questions as we come up.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Adjuvants. Adjuvants are chemicals used to help herbicides bind to foliage. Adjuvants were reported, and adjuvants in themselves can be toxic. Some are more toxic than others. And adjuvants were reported being used for some but not all sprays. We are unsure if the records that did not have adjuvants listed did not use them or if they were not reported. If adjuvants were not if adjuvants were used but not reported, that would be a violation of the reporting requirements. As we've talked about before, tank mixes were common. This is when you combine a bunch of chemicals together. On the slide right now, these are just three examples of tank mixes that were typical in the study area. The choice of tank mixes are made independently by the pesticide applicator. Also, the regulations do not cover the practice of mixing more than one active ingredient or adjuvant. There are no health studies to answer questions about the impacts of synergistic and cumulative exposure to multiple pesticides or the additional chemicals such as adjuvants or inerts added to these tank mixes.
And if I might just say, these are from the actual spray records. So these are actual tank mixes recorded by the spray operator.
So I had mentioned the word synergistic effects. Research has shown that effects from tank mixes are not necessarily additive. The chemicals can interact and result in a higher toxicity.
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm. Senator Olson.
Ladies, I've just been through your entire thing on OLAS here, and I don't see any of those charts indicating the test results. Is that going to come in some other conversation, or do you... Or did you just not put it in this presentation?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Olson, are you referring to the urinalysis charts?
Well, yeah, you just mentioned that you did 40 samples in the spring of 2011 and 61, but there's not a single data of information in your presentation to show the results of those and say when they were taken, who they were taken by, how they were done. Is that going to come in another conversation or...
Chair and Senator Olson, we did not take the samples, and we don't have access to any of that data. That's personal medical records. We only are reporting
the results. Then
we're reporting to this committee what was published by the Oregon Health Authority in their report that came out on May 9th, 2013, just a month ago. So you would find it all in this report.
We will. That report just came out. We'll make sure that you get a link to it.
Well, I would just think that if you're going to make this evaluation, that certainly you would put that in your presentation that this is what happened, because the good doctor asked, questions about it, and I would think that that would be very critical to your presentation.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, we would agree with you, but we do not have access to those medical records. We just don't.
Never mind.
Why don't you go ahead and keep going?
Okay. It's difficult to evaluate human health impacts, but now we continue on to the section where we do our very best to evaluate them. There was a system developed by Cornell University and the New York State College of Agriculture and Life Sciences by Dr. Kovach and his team, and it's called the Field Use Environmental Impact Quotient. It's a method to calculate the overall environmental impact of most common pesticides. That includes insecticides and herbicides. The goal of this environmental impact assessment is to develop a common currency to assess environmental and economic impacts of the use of pesticides. The values obtained from these calculations can be used to compare different pesticides and pest management programs to ultimately determine which programs or pesticide is likely to have the lower or higher environmental impact. The formula was developed using data gathered by the EPA pesticide registration process. This is a time when the manufacturer of a product must provide the government a wealth of toxicological and environmental impact data. We compared the environmental impact quotient for 3 years of data, and we were able that we were able to obtain. By applying the environmental impact quotient field rating, we could make comparisons between the various pest management applications and strategies. We are using this method because Oregon Department of Agriculture, Oregon Department of Forestry, and timber companies have of yet failed to evaluate the environmental health impacts of their practices. The environmental impact quotient can also be used to compare and contrast the relative environmental health impact for each year, and we're going to go through the years with you. This chart provides a relative rating for each spray operation in 2009. This helps us understand that the choice of 2,4-D, atrazine, and hexazinone, all the chemicals sprayed in the spring, have the highest environmental impacts relative to other chemical choices. In 2010, the highest environmental impact quotient is again for 2,4-D and atrazine, so the pattern bears out. In 2011, the year that the residents in Triangle Lake complained to the Oregon Pesticide Analytic Response Board, otherwise known as PARC, about illnesses they were experiencing, was also the year that urine samples were collected in both the spring and the fall. 2011 had a dramatic increase in the number of acres sprayed and also had a greater amount of sprays at higher environmental impact quotient ratings. Atrazine, in this case, accounts for the greatest impacts. In the spring of 2011, urine sampling, when they did the urine sampling in 2011, as I said, 100% of the residents had atrazine and 2,4-D detected in their urine. This included children as young as six. The Oregon Health Authority, in their report, concluded that all urine samples collected in the spring of 2011 were, and I quote, statistically higher than those found in the general population, close quote. Then, in 2011, in the fall, 92% of 64 residents tested had detectable levels of 2,4-D in their urine. 25 of the 64 residents had 2,4-D levels that were higher than the general population and higher than anticipated. In the fall of 2011, there was no atrazine detections in residents' urine. So, well, what does this data mean in terms of human health? Is it a concern that more than 92% of those folks tested in the first in the second test in the fall and 100% in the test in the spring had pesticides in their bodies? Well, it's difficult to say because the EPA does not have human health standards for these pesticides. In other words, the government has not yet established a number deemed to be safe or not safe for carrying around pesticides in one's body. What the EPA does have is a drinking water standard for 2,4-D and atrazine. That standard is called the maximum contaminant level, or MDL. We can compare the level of pesticides in the body of Oregon rural residents with the EPA drinking water standard as one type of comparison. The following slide is a chart that compares these numbers. As you'll see in this chart, we looked at 2,4-D and atrazine because these were the only chemicals that were tested for in the residents of Triangle Lake area. Detections in the urine are higher than EPA standards for drinking water. In other words, Oregon residents are excreting more than is allowed for the level of ingestion. This is true for both 2,4-D and atrazine. They're higher than the maximum contaminant level in drinking water. So we're going to conclude with some observations based on record-keeping issues, policy, and policy recommendations.
We found the application records to not be consistent at all. There's no standard form. And depending on the company, some forms were more complete than others. Some included maps, and many did not. The Oregon administrative rule, there is an Oregon administrative rule that specifies what data needs to be included in spray records. Some records were not meeting this rule. We specifically found that ground spray records were not always complete. Some were missing locations. Some were missing acres sprayed. Here's an example of a spray record that was missing acres. There's even no place on the form of where actual number of acres sprayed could be listed. They just have a, can't read it from here. there's a rate per acre, but not actually a place for the number of acres. And This was quite disturbing to us. We found 7 sprays from November 11th through December 6th in 2010 with the exact same weather data, the same relative humidity, the same wind data, and more importantly, the same temperatures. They started the day at 62 degrees and ended it in 70 degrees. And again, in November, that was November 11th, November 12th, same temperature.
Oops, I'm going faster than you.
November 15th, same temperature. November, and all the other data, November 16th, same temperature. December 2nd, still 62 to 70 degrees. December 3rd, and finally, December 6th. All 7 days had a starting temperature of 62 degrees and an ending temperature of 70 degrees. These temperatures may not be surprising in May and June, but we did question them for November and December. For lack of a better word of how to title this slide, we call it scattered records. Beyond Toxics requested outstanding records, and we did receive 26 additional records that were not part of the original request from Oregon Health Authority. A central place for all spray records would help solve these kinds of discrepancies.
I think it was Senator Przanski mentioned that residents can request notifications. This is an typical example of a notification that Oregon residents can request. Notifications are paid for by the residents. They are $5 a section with a minimum fee of $25. So if you're surrounded by a lot of forestry land, you would pay $5 a section, and it could add up to many, many hundreds of dollars. These notifications do not list the spray date. They do not list the day or the week. In many cases, they give a date range of January through December or March through December. There's no way for the resident to know when the spray might occur. They provide a list of many possible chemicals, but they don't identify which chemicals will actually be used. And they don't identify buffers from streams, and they don't identify how homes or schools would be protected. So on the example you have here, you can see that, well, it's hard to know what you're looking at, essentially. They just give a township range and section. There's no lat or long coordinates. There's no way to really find out where you are in this map. In 2011, Beyond Toxics testified before the Board of Forestry about the need for a web-based notification system that is accessible to all Oregonians without a fee. Mr. Decker, Oregon State Forester, agreed with us that this suggestion was viable. In 2013, Oregon Department of Forestry is moving forward with developing an online system of spray notifications. However, the Oregon Department of Forestry has not yet verified that the system will be available to persons who request and need notifications, nor has ODF agreed to provide the minimum amount of data to ensure that residents receive notice of the location of the spray, when the spray will occur, and what will be sprayed, which chemicals. Nor has there been an accommodation for not charging such hefty fees for rural residents. Oregon Department of Forestry needs to ensure that there is more specific data that is freely available to rural residents, and that the specific data to help them take steps to protect their health is there for them. We'd like to discuss some of the policies that might be possible to protect human health. And so we're going to compare Washington forest practices with Oregon forest practices, and also Oregon forest practices with federal forest practices. There are models out there that do a better job of providing for human health. So if we compare just some of the key elements of Washington and Oregon's Forest Practices Act, you can see there are significant differences in the ability to protect residences, to protect agricultural lands. You may have heard there's been a number of lawsuits of grape growers suing timber companies because of drift onto grape products, grape vineyards, excuse me. Also, Washington requires posting. There is an agency review period, which Oregon does not have. They review chemicals if there's a label of caution or warning on the product. There's a public access to these notifications, and there's a 7-year period for record keeping compared to Oregon's 3-year record data record-keeping requirement, which would help in more data analysis and looking for trends. In terms of the U.S. forests, we here have a quote from Jim Furnish, who is the former U.S. Forest Service Deputy Chief and also manager of the Siuslaw National Forest. The U.S. Forest Service stopped spraying for logging practices. They do not use any form of aerial pesticide application. They stopped that practice in the 1980s. When the courts took away herbicides from the Forest Service in the Northwest, foresters found other viable and successful tools. Now we'd like to move on and talk about buffers for schools and residents. This is Triangle Lake School, as it was in 2007 when I happened to be out there and took a picture of it. The following year, this is the same school. There was a clear cut right down to the school grounds. There was no buffer at all for this school. This is the scene from the back of the school. Those are classrooms on the right. That's a very steep hill. We went back to this site recently. These are more recent pictures. You can see the hillside there developing. And the timber operator sprayed imazapyr on this hillside that you see there behind Triangle Lake School after the logging. Excuse me one second. I'm ahead of myself. In spring of 2012, 22 Oregon schools participated in the United States Department of Agriculture's analysis of drinking water for rural schools. Half of those schools in Oregon had pesticides in the school's drinking water. The hillside above Triangle Lake was sprayed with imazapyr, as I said, in December of 2010, and then the following year, imazapyr was detected in the drinking water of this school by the USDA. So we'd like to now summarize some of the facts.
There was a 56% increase in acres of forest aerial sprayed from 2009 to 2011, a 99% increase of pounds of pesticides aerial sprayed from 2009 to 2011. And then when just looking at that seasonal trend, we see a 226% increase in aerial sprays from spring 2009 to 2011. Then this, I just want to point out, too, those top ones, the increase in acres and the increase in pounds per pounds of pesticide, there is the rate of pounds per acre is also increasing, as you can see, because the acres just went up 56% and then the pounds went up 99%. Springtime sprays have a higher environmental impact to human health, and it appears that the choices of which chemicals are used increases or lessens the environmental impact.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Just a quick question. I'm going to have to leave a little bit earlier, but, you know, I was looking at all this data that is done. You know, the obvious question that comes to my mind is, how is this, you know, is it all relative? And so where do you measure from? What's dangerous, what's not dangerous? And this environmental impact quotient, the EIQ that you mentioned, does that measure the pounds per acre? Or, you know, and who establishes that? Is that something that's recognized by the state or the federal government? Or, I mean, is that a tool that we should be looking at? I guess that's my question. Or are we looking at it? You're obviously looking at it.
Chair Dingfelder and Representative Holvey, that's a really excellent question. The environmental impact quotient, as we said, was developed by Cornell University, is used in the field. It's used everywhere from golf courses to farms to buildings to determine what the most efficacious pesticide treatment would be. So they compare and contrast all sorts of different ones, and they enter into it all of the toxicity data compiled by the EPA. You can find this formula online. It's been published. It's been used in juried publications, and so we would put into the formula itself the active ingredient, the percent of active ingredient, the rate of spray, the acreage sprayed, and then it sort of helps you get a relative number. It is relative. You're right. It is a relative number. You may not remember that chart, but it went from 0 to 60. And I spoke with Dr. Kovach about this and told him we were using his research to try to understand the environmental health impacts because there is no other way to do it, and I understand Senator Olson's frustration about your analysis. Again, we're a nonprofit. We don't have access to that data unless someone were to volunteer it. So we have to use other methods of trying to understand the impacts. Dr. Kovach said this was an appropriate usage of his formula. And we also know that Oregon State University is developing their own environmental impact quotient system. It's in beta testing right now, so we couldn't use that yet because it's not been published. Did that answer your question adequately?
It did. I was curious whether the Oregon Health Authority uses something similar.
No, they do not. And we have used the system previously to look at pesticide spray along roadsides, and we shared the data with ODOT. And following that, the director of ODOT, Matthew Garrett, did make the pledge that ODOT would reduce their use of herbicide spray along roadsides by 25% by the year 2015 because this data helped them assess where the worst environmental impacts were and where they might be able to make improvements. So it is kind of a raw tool. But getting at the human health impact is difficult unless you were to bring on a team of medical professionals, probably.
Okay, why don't you keep on going?
2,4-D and atrazine have the highest relative environmental impact. In the spring of 2011, atrazine and 2,4-D were detected in 100% of the urine analysis of the local residents. Concentrations of herbicides in urine were higher than EPA drinking water standards. And we also wanted to point out here that residents have not been tested for any other pesticides than atrazine and 2,4-D, so the exposure to the other chemicals is unknown. Record keeping. Spray records are not always accurate or consistent, and under current Oregon Forest Practices Act, researchers do not have access to the spray data for, like how Senator Prezansky suggested earlier, that it took quite a while for Oregon Health Authority to get a hold of these records.
And while we were waiting to get a hold of those records, records were being destroyed if they were one day older than 3 years. So there's a lot of records that are missing that we will never have access to. Some of the key differences between the forest policies are listed in the bullet points here, including the ability for agencies to actually review the use of pesticides, for the public to have access to data, and to establish buffer zones to protect human health and environmental resources. The Oregon Forest Practices Act lacks these aspects. And federal lands, including the BLM, have not aerially sprayed logging units since, well, for more than 20 years there, and they've been doing okay. This is another view of Triangle Lake School after the clear cut occurred around it. And we recommend some immediate actions to this esteemed committee. There could be efforts made to make Oregon Forest Practices Act at least as effective as the Washington Forest Practices Act. We could be studying and adopting some federal forestry models. It's a good time to convene a 2013 legislative interim task force on forest practices and include the Board of Forestry since these policies come under their purview. We should not limit work groups to agencies only, but include the NGOs and the impacted communities who have given years of their time and hundreds of hours of research into this, and there could be some recommendations forwarded to the 2014 legislature. So that is the end, although I want to make one other comment. We do have the individual spray records. It's a massive data set, so we knew we were on limited time here, but again, to answer Senator Olson, if we'd brought our entire Excel file, we could pinpoint which sprays were made on which dates. And if someone would provide us the information of the dates the year-end analysis were done, we could make that comparison.
Okay. Thank you, ladies. We can have the lights turned up, Shelley. See if there's any questions or any comments of any of the representatives from the area you want to add.
I appreciate the OHA report, and it indicated that from a health perspective, none of the two listed, and they did admit that atrazine doesn't seem to have an amount that's deal, but that they felt that none of them were posing a health risk at this time for those people. How they came up with that for atrazine, I don't know, but that was part of it. But the levels were relatively low. And comparing it to water, amounts you have in water, we keep that really low so that the additive amount of drinking the water can't cause it to get bigger and meal. So it's not, I don't know that that's a really fair comparison with respect to what the health risks are. It's been an interesting kind of study, and I think it's created a lot of issues in the community, and I feel bad about that part, so I need to continue to work with the community so that they feel better about each other and so on and so forth.
Well, and also
and
there
the water, and ground studies where they took records, they did not find much of this chemical, so it must break down fairly quickly like you're saying, but there was some found in one water sample, if I remember right, from the...
And Representative Holvey or Senator Prezanski, can you comment on what your understanding of the work group that the governor is going to be pulling together will be addressing?
I can't speak for the governor's office and what they will address. I know some of the conversations did revolve around the efficiency or lack of efficiency of being able to get accurate data to examine when we do have problems so that they actually, all the different agencies, know what was sprayed, when it was sprayed, how much. And that data is absolutely crucial to making any kind of conclusion about anything that's happened. And if you don't have that data, you're not going to have a conclusive report. And so I think that's one thing that the governor's office, in my conversation with them, did recognize, that their system of spray collection data was inadequate to actually do a thorough investigation, and that they were going to look at potentially doing something programmatic between the agencies to have better data.
Okay. So did you want to add anything, Senator Prezanski?
Yeah, just following up, I think that's really what I got from governor's staff, is that they're really looking at the agency level. How does this information come forward, who actually gets it, and then how do agencies that may have a need for that, such as doing a health review, have access to that information? And one of the questions was, our issues is, once the data is received, I believe in this case from the Department of Ag, how it is dispersed or distributed to like a health agency that's looking at public health issues. Also, there is some discussion possibly looking at programmatically how they could actually improve it by requiring maybe direct reports coming to the agency. Right now, this stuff, from what I understand, is not electronic database digital. It's handwritten out, and so that in itself causes an issue. And I think that was one of the reasons that it took so much time to actually be able to get that information in a form that it could be used. I thought I'd heard that they were looking at maybe making it where it would be more user-friendly for the applicators to just be able to download that into a database at a state agency, and then you'd have it there. And if it's digital, it'd make it much more easy and receptive to other agencies who may be doing some type of investigation.
Did you have a comment?
A comment and then a couple of questions that I don't think you probably could answer them. I'm not trying to put you in the spot. First off, what happened at the school was pretty shocking. I mean, that's one bad actor makes everybody look bad. I mean, whoever did that was clearly not thinking. You know, you can choose to leave a buffer zone next to a grade school. Come on. It's just common sense. Okay. And it's hard to believe someone did it. But anyway, I'd be interested in knowing, if there's been epidemiological studies on long-term effects. Is there a higher incidence of certain types of cancers in the community? That sort of thing over a long period of time, 20 or 30 years. I'm assuming herbicides and pesticides have been used for a long time, even though you don't have records. And so, you know, the CDC may have that information. State has some records by death certificates, but it's not real accurate sometimes. CDC should help you more. And then try to trace that back to other exposures that might cause it. This reminds me a lot, unfortunately, of Agent Orange. Many of us were exposed to that, and 30 years later now, we have about 4 times instance of diabetes and leukemia among people who were exposed at a time when we thought Agent Orange was pretty safe. I'm not saying this is Agent Orange, okay, but we didn't know anything about it at that time, and it took years before we found out there was a problem. And you really got to look at a large population over a long period of time to see if you do or don't have a problem, and you're just getting started in this. So you need a longer study over more lives to really figure out if you got something going on here or not.
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, just one more comment for that is this is just an example of what happens in rural Western Washington, Oregon, and, you know, just one area. It's not just Triangle Lake. It's lots of other areas where rural residents live amongst commercial timberlands.
Senator
Robles? Yeah, I guess, too, did you find any records that would indicate that they were applied outside of the levels that the industry gives them to do it? So, I mean, every one of these pesticides has restrictions on how to go about using it, and that they say have been tested wherever that's testing at, federal government or whatever, because each pesticide has its own uses. Did we see any pesticide use that would indicate that they were not doing it in accordance with the level, the way they were supposed to be using pesticides?
Senator Dingfelder and Senator Robin, we are only looking at the application records provided by the spray operator. We have film of practices that were what we would call illegal, helicopters flying in the rain and heavy winds while spraying. That would be in violation of the label. The label is the law. The other thing that the report, the OHA report says is that the amount of these two chemicals found in the urine was significantly higher than the general population and was of concern, and that they don't think the pathway of exposures through either water, their drinking water, nor the soil, nor the plants, but they believe it's coming from aerial drift, and they made the statement in the report that it appears that atrazine and 2,4-D might be drifting as far as 2 to 2.5 miles from the site of application. And we didn't go into it because we knew we'd be out of time, but the one aerial shot where we showed the steep ravines, there was a forensic agronomist who did a drift study and showed how the way that mountains channel the air currents to really move swiftly right down the Highway 36 corridor.
The atrazine, my understanding is it takes very little to cause damage to plants. I mean, if it gets on a plant, you'll see it. So if there was drift, would you not have expected to find a lot of other foliage that had died because of the drift? I mean, I know that's one of the lawsuits has to do with grapes, and they say it takes very little, and there's been indication. And in that case, it's pretty clear. You can see it. And my understanding was there didn't appear to be any drift damage to other foliage. Was that true, or do we not know?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Roblin, again, the Oregon Health Authority and their cohorts in ODA and ODF did the testing of the foliage and the soils. They didn't test, as far as I know, they did not test any products in agricultural settings. There are farms in this area. I don't think they tested any farms that I read about in the report or that I know of. I've been to every single meeting.
They tested the food. I mean, they put food products
that
were grown there.
On the personal property of just residents, but not commercial food.
Oh, I don't
and
know.
They didn't find any. And we don't know, I mean, we as a society do not know how sensitive the human body is to inhalation, and are we more sensitive than the leaf of a plant? We don't know.
And the last one, I know that one of the people that I talked to was very concerned because she had some of the highest levels, but she wasn't concerned with all the other people. She was concerned how she was using pesticides because 2,4-D is in just about it. I mean, it's got turf builder. It's in everything. So, I mean, in our society, it's one of the more commonly used pesticides. And so she said, I was worried, and then they told me my health was okay. So she's like 85 or 90 years old. But she said, I was more concerned that they were going to say that I was using pesticides around the household and other things badly than she was, that somebody else was spraying her, but she said made her. But and then I realized that 2,4-D is the most common. Atrazine, you won't find it unless, I mean, it's about the only place that's used right now is around that I found this timber. But those other chemicals would be good.
Senator Hansel, yeah.
I just follow up on Dr. Bates, Senator Bates's question. Who owned that hillside that was right next to the school that caused it to be harvested out there?
Senator Dingfelder and Senator Hansel. The hills, at least halfway up the hillside, is owned by the school, and Weyerhaeuser owns the surrounding area. According to the principal of the school, Weyerhaeuser came to the school board and told them that if they did not allow Weyerhaeuser to take down the trees, the school could be the victim of blowdown because of the way the wind patterns are. So they advised the school to allow them to take the trees for safety purposes.
Well, that's a whole different picture than what your slide showed then.
Well, they still burn during, they still slash burn during school hours.
Yeah.
I don't care. I'm just saying you showed these and highlighted that as a raping of the land, and it was school district owned it, and they gave permission to log it for a safety factor. A little different than what I picked up, but that's okay.
Yes, they did give permission, and it's probably a smaller area than the buffer zone, for example, that is required by Washington State, but yes.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Brzezinski.
Just one comment. There were two other individuals who requested to be here, and I'm not sure if you made any mention, Aaron King and Justin Workman. They also approached me, and I told them that they would be welcome here. Apparently, they had some concerns as to their participation and what effect it may or may not have, and they chose not to be here based on an email that was sent to my office this morning.
Okay. Thank you for the comment. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming here today. And I guess we will hear from the senators on follow-up as the work group moves forward. I know you'll be working on this tomorrow and keep us posted.
Yes.
So with that, we are done for the day with the informational part of the meeting, and we are adjourned.